This afternoon, as part of the Greater Capital Region Teacher Senate grant entitled "It's Time Has Come: Supplementary Materials for Teaching the Vietnam War," we have the pleasure and honor of interviewing Mr. Ernie Amavli, Director of the Vietnam, New York State Vietnam Memorial.
I got to get it right corrected now, so they won't
kill me. Want to thank you for doing this.
I mean, sure.
I can, awful busy. I can tell by next door and all the things that are going on.
We get besieged at times. We have a wide range of interests.
Maybe you want to start with that? Maybe talking about your functions.
Sure, I can give you a little overview of the memorial, a little background.
Great.
Okay. New York State Vietnam Memorial was created by an act of the legislature in 1981. In the approval message, then-Governor Kerry said that it was his hope that the memorial would not only honor those who did not return, but those veterans who survived and live among us. And that kind of, as far as I know, created the living memorial concept. When Governor Cuomo dedicated the memorial in 1984, with a very eloquent speech in a well-attended ceremony, he amplified that theme of a living memorial. And he said something to the effect that we would mock those who were killed if we don't honor the living. So what we do here, we have our resource center, which as you can see is the home of our permanent collection of artwork, some of our permanent collection. We don't have room for all of it in here. We also have a fairly extensive print and video library. And we keep this room open. It's a very lively place. People come in and out of here. We have meetings here. We have we make the space available to vet organizations, et cetera. We show videos throughout the day, so people, pedestrian traffic, can come by and check us out. And next door we have our art gallery. And the art gallery is pretty much, we use that as a forum for Vietnam vet artists. Many Vietnam vet artists have had their first one-man show in our gallery. It's a very small gallery, and it's real conducive to the concept of a one-man show. We have had other types of exhibits as well. Once a year, we do an exhibit of incarcerated Vietnam vet artwork. We reach out to the correctional facilities. It's something we sponsor with the Department of Correctional Services. And we get Vietnam vets, some 4,000 Vietnam vets who are behind bars. We get some very powerful work from them. We do that once a year. So that's basically it. We have our courtyard, which surrounds us here on the exterior of this wall. And we will have an honor roll of the 4,200 New York casualties from Vietnam War. They will be engraved in bronze and installed in those freestanding pedestals up there. That'll be a big draw. People come to the courtyard and people think of a memorial in traditional terms, mm-hmm. and they expect to see the names of the casualties. I think maybe the dedication of the National Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, the wall, is kind of forever redefined the concept of a memorial. So people expect to see the names, and we think that's a good idea too. So we're in the process of doing that, and that should be available by next year. In fact, we've already awarded the bid. And then we do special cultural and educational programming. We've sponsored Vietnam vet artists. Last year we did a program with the New York State Writers Institute. We brought Vietnam vet novelist Tim O'Brien here. Tim read from his works and he answered questions about how the Vietnam War experience kind of led into a life of fiction. So it was a very well-attended and very, very, very powerful experience. And we've also brought Wallace Terry here. Wallace Terry is the author of Bloods, an oral history of Black Vietnam veterans. And we've done some other programs as well. Last year we did a musical program entitled Jody's Got Your Cadillac by former Green Beret Chuck Rosenberg. He's collected Vietnam folk songs. There's a whole body of music that was given to the Library of Congress's Music Division by the late General Edward Lansdale. Lansdale was the architect of American psychological operations in Vietnam, but he was also an amateur folklorist. And he was there during the early war years, and his home in Saigon was kind of a meeting place for all kinds of characters. And they would make up tunes. They had lively parties, make up tunes, and set them to either traditional or Tin Pan Alley kind of melodies. And some of it was really brilliant stuff in the Tom Lehrer School of social and political satire. And Lansdale collected all this stuff. He had a tape recorder and recorded it all and deposited it in the Library of Congress's music division, as I said, back in the 70s. So Chuck Rosenberg has had access to all that material, and he's developing it into a show, and we premiered that last year ago, Memorial Day, at the Egg. So those are the kinds of things we do.
Could you locate the place where people, like, for teachers who might be watching this tape?
You know, we're at the extreme northeast corner of the Empire State Plaza. That's the lower State Street area, closest to the telephone company. And we're in the lobby.
And teachers would be more than welcome to...
Oh, sir. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'll make a note of that if they don't
see
this.
As I said, our print and video library collection is fairly extensive, and we make that available to anyone who requests it.
Thanks. Can we just return the channel with a little personal note? Can you just kind of fill us in real quickly, just what about your background, mm-hmm. Prior to you going to Vietnam?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was a working class Catholic boy who grew up on Sycamore Street in St. Teresa's Parish and went to St. Teresa's Grammar and Junior High School, and I went to Vincentian Institute for high school, and was an athlete. I was captain of the football team at VI and intended and was all set to go to Brockport State to play football. My coach at VI had arranged a grant and aid program with Brockport State. I had gone up and met the football coach and the athletic director, and things looked as if they were all wrapped up. Lo and behold, in July, I got a letter saying that they had exceeded their quota and they couldn't take me until the spring semester, which meant I wasn't going to play football. And basically, the only reason I wanted to go to school was to play football. So I took off a year, and next September, I figured I didn't want to go back for the spring semester. I couldn't play football, so I decided I would go back in the fall. And one thing led to another, and I was, a 19-year-old kid, 18, turning 19, and hanging out, and just kind of, working a job, and just kind of experiencing a little freedom for a while, And lo and behold, I got a draft notice. I had fully intended to go to college. The war intervened, so I was drafted in November of '66 and went to basic training out at Fort Ord, California. It was during the big buildup of the war. In fact, every training facility on the East Coast was filled, and I ended up going from New York State to Fort Ord, California for basic training. And I was part of a whole battalion of East Coast guys that were going basic training at Fort Ord. At Fort Ord, I got orders for Fort Polk, Louisiana for advanced infantry training, and Fort Polk, Louisiana was where they trained grunts, the 11 Bravos, as we were called, light weapons infantrymen. So I went to Fort Polk for infantry training and then right to Vietnam.
Polk, from what the guys have told me, Polk seemed to be the magic word. If you went to Polk, you knew you were going to Vietnam.
Yeah, they had what they called Peace on Ridge there. And that was a simulated jungle environment. And it was the closest thing they had for jungle training for enlisted men. Officers got jungle training down in Panama. Fort Polk was where the enlisted men got their jungle training.
One of the purposes, one of the reasons why I'm doing this tape is to try to deal with some of this and the stereotypes that have developed about the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. You were very, 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 very addressed the one, and that's mm-hmm. that myth that it's almost a direct quote from something I read, and I should have brought the book with me, and the Vietnam War basically was fought by the uneducated classes for the, you've heard that.
Yeah, I don't know if I share that political analysis or that social analysis. Yeah, for the most part, it was working class kids. If you look at the records of New York State casualties, we have a statistical breakdown of those casualties. An overwhelming majority of them profess to be Roman Catholics. So we infer that we had a lot of working class Italian, Irish, Polish, as well as, of course, Hispanics. I would say uneducated would not really be relevant, but certainly working class,
working
and whatever
class.
That implies.
Okay. I was trying to get you anticipate my question, because the guys I've met at this point, they've all basically were trained on the East Coast. I can't think of the name of it, because somebody was telling me the casualty rate was so high at that particular place that they started to reassign them. Escapes my mind right now.
An infantry training site on the East Coast?
Yeah.
It was Fort Jackson, it was Fort, in Georgia, Fort Benning.
Everybody up to this point has gone there. You're the first one who
went to Polk? Yeah.
Your second guy went to Polk, but everybody else has always been trained on the East Coast. And,
For basic?
For basic training, right. I just can't get the name of it. Hey, were you aware of Vietnam prior to your draft?
Yeah, in fact, prior to my draft, I always considered myself to be fairly well informed. In fact, I remember being interviewed in our the VI newspaper, Blue Banner, and I was struck by, I still have that, by the way, and all I wanted, it was like little nuggets of information on each person, and likes and dislikes. And one of the things I disliked was Barry Goldwater. So even back then, I had some kind of a political understanding of what Barry Goldwater meant as opposed to Lyndon Johnson. I knew about Vietnam. I knew, for example, that there was a. I was familiar with Dr. Tom Dooley. So I knew that in Southeast Asia you had this, the classic struggle as we knew it between democracy and communism. And I was very much, as a Roman Catholic who prayed in grammar school for the conversion of Russia, I was very much interested in seeing that democracy. Now, so, yeah, I was aware of Vietnam. In fact, I remember, this was after my draft notice, but I remember having a discussion with my mother at my kitchen table when I was talking about being drafted. If you were drafted in 1966 in November, you kind of knew that you were drafted because of the war, and it was somewhat likely that you would end up in Vietnam. So I was discussing it with my mother, and I thought it might be a good thing for me to do. I felt strongly that it was the right cause. And I felt, I was quite young, but I was moved by Kennedy and that new frontier. And, I just thought it was an appropriate extension of our foreign policy to be involved.
How did you ride?
Yeah, I flew. We left Travers Air Force Base in Oakland and flew commercial. I think it was TWA.
Did you go by yourself? Or did you go with any?
It was all a function of dates. So a lot of guys that I was with at Fort Polk who went over with me, but there were other people as well.
Did you stay together when you were there, or did you get dispersed?
When we got to a place called 93 Placement Battalion, that's where this was the step one of the DIRO system. You're familiar with the DIRO system, how people rotated back 365 days after their tour began. Well, this was where we backfilled. 93 Placement was where they backfilled those units when people were leaving to return to the States after their year of duty. So once you got to 9th Replacement Battalion, you would go wherever you were needed. So on the day that I was there, 2 days, I had orders for the 11th Armored Cavalry, which I have since recognized as being quite a fortunate situation.
What do you mean by, I want to go back, but what do you mean by fortunate?
Well, because...
Something you want to get into.
Well, very briefly, I was 11 Bravo, light weapons infantryman, and I ended up going to a cavalry, which meant I was going to be riding on ACATs, armored cavalry assault vehicles, as opposed to humping the boonies on my feet.
Oh, okay.
So, that, yeah, that in itself was quite fortunate.
If you reflected, you thought about, because it's one of the things that keeps, I keep referring to practically every interview, so, is the fact that they sent guys over as individuals, like when you're drawing contrast and you're comparing it to World War II, when guys seem to run over in units, and yet in Vietnam they run over individually. Mm-hmm. Do you see, is that negative, positive, that make a difference?
It made a tremendous difference, I think, on every aspect of the war and the aftermath. Obviously, being there for 1 year and 1 year only meant that you were replacing your seasoned combat troops on a regular basis. You know, by the time 6-8 months rolled around, you were just beginning to feel somewhat comfortable. You were always rotating in a group of rookie or fresh recruits, FNGs. FNG, we know what that means. On that level, yes, it had a very, I think, important effect. And also, when you get to the whole issue of the plight of Vietnam veterans, you factor in the fact that veterans left after a year, and on the 366th day, they were back on their block in their neighborhoods without any time to decompress, to discuss their experiences with their peers. I mean, you could get in a conversation with a stranger on the Freedom Bird on the way home, but in all probability, his experience didn't approximate yours either. I mean, the Vietnam War was really a function of not only where you were, but when you were there. Because you could, you know, the person who replaced you in your unit as you left, the person that stepped in to do your job, had a totally different experience because of the fact that it was a year later.
There's about 20 things going through my mind here. I'm going to get confused on it. One of the things that keeps coming over and over again, and I guess I did this 6 minutes ago, it's almost a loneliness. I think that's the one thing that's hit me the hardest during these interviews. So the loneliness, in a sense, going over, the loneliness coming back. Somebody made a really valid point that, here again, World War II, soldiers coming back, they had, just because of the nature of their transportation, they had 2 weeks to come back. Mm-hmm. And, they were with guys that basically they kind of knew that with units.
Sure.
Maybe we could talk about it in a couple minutes. I don't know why the government should have, maybe they were not aware of what was going on.
Yeah, here's why they did it. And this is stuff that appears in the Pentagon Papers. It was determined that the least disruptive system for society, for the home front, is to take men out singly and individually and replace them singly and individually. That would have, it was argued by the think tank people, that would have the least disruptive effect on our American society at home. There was never a thought given to what it would do to the fighting man, what it would do upon his return home. It was, how can we minimize opposition to the war by keeping everyone at home relatively happy, or at least unhappy to a certain extent, relatively unhappy, or relatively happy.
Are you saying that the protest that was going on within the country is what helped make that decision, or was it just?
I don't know if it was that. I think decision to use that Diros system probably predates most of the anti-war activity. I think it was just, you know, we've got, you know, they knew what they had. They didn't want a full-blown encounter in Vietnam. And I think all the tentative steps they took to get to that level in 1968-69 of having, you know, over 500,000 troops there, I think, you know, they were feeling their way gradually. They didn't want to, the prospects for opposition at home, they wanted to kind of nip that in the bud, foreclose on that. So they adopted these measures, one of which was the Diros system.
Am I being too critical of government when I say I just simply don't understand on the opposite end why they didn't start to catch this at some point? I mean,
well,
you had guys coming home, like you said before, they were home the next day. They were on the streets.
See, I don't know.
There was no debriefing or whatever you want to call it.
No, that's true. I don't know if the government was concerned about that at all, and I don't think too many vets were. I mean, when I came home, I remember going to the bar that I hung out in before I left, and I walked in and somebody came up to me and said, "How you doing?" and asked what I had been doing. But I hadn't seen this guy for a year or so.
Uh-huh.
He didn't even know I was from Vietnam. So I said, "Oh, I was in Vietnam." And the guy said, "Oh, well, did you see a game last night?" You know, there was no discussion at all about it. Nobody, and I didn't particularly want to talk about it either. Of course, when other guys that I knew who had been there came back, we would talk. But to non-vets, you know, I could live without not discussing the war. So. I'd rather live without discussing all this. So, I don't think that was noticed by our government, that it wasn't a good way to reintroduce the veterans to civilian life. I don't think that was ever an issue. And as far as fighting the war with fresh recruits, keep in mind that the typical ground soldier, foot soldier in Vietnam was 19 years old, as opposed to 26 in World War II. And 19-year-old kids can be pretty crazy.
Yeah.
They can be pretty brave and heroic. And so, I don't know if it had an adverse effect on the outcome of the war using young replacements.
I guess because I coach and I always look at things from team concept to sending a bunch of guys over together to fight as a unit. It just seems to be more productive that way than trying to fit in individuals into.
Well, Vince Lombardi
had
run the war effort. We probably would have fared differently.
It might have been different. Your first impression of Vietnam is, where did you land and what was your first impression?
Benoit Airport. First impression was that it was awfully hot, and I remember being amazed that there were Vietnamese in conical hats and black pajamas right on the base. And I'm saying to myself, I don't understand, who is the enemy here? I mean, I thought the people in the conical hats and black pajamas were the enemy, but as it turned out, Vietnamese civilians were. It was the country, and they were all over the place.
Uh-huh.
So I was a little confused about all that. But that was my first impression, being a little confused.
You mentioned it before. What basically did you do in your tour?
Well, I as I said, I was fortunate to have been a like weapons infantrymen who went to a armored cavalry unit. Once I got to the 11th Armored Cav, I was fortunate again in that we presented ourselves. We went by truck from 9th Replacement Battalion, a 5-ton military cargo plane, from 9th Replacement to Swan Lock, or Soon Lock in Vietnamese, where the 11th Cav had their base camp. And then I got there, the first sergeant in the headquarters company, headquarters troop, read off a list of names. I was one of those names. And asked if we could drive a truck. So, you know, my father's advice was never to volunteer, but I knew driving a truck was going to be better than anything else I could do. So I'd never driven a truck, but I didn't let on. So for my first month in country, I was TDY, which I'm not sure what it means, but it means at a temporary duty station in Cholon, which is the it's the Chinese ghetto district of Vietnam, of Saigon, rather. It's across the canal that runs through Saigon. It's like the twin city of Saigon, Cholon. I was living with some other 11th Cav people in an abandoned rice mill there. And there was a contingent of MPs. And so I lived pretty much almost as a civilian for my first month. We would take a convoy from Cholon to Long Binh to Swan Lock and then go back the next day. And we did that for a month. So we'd spend a night in Cholon, a night in Swan Lock base camp. And then when we were done with that particular thing, I forgot to mention that the 11th Armored Cav was just in the process of setting up a base camp. And that's why there was a need for this kind of stuff. So once I got back to my unit, the guys that I'd gone to the unit with had already been assigned to various troops, mostly 1st Squadron troops. And I was sent to headquarters. So although I retained my military occupation as 11 Bravo, light weapons infantry, I did a lot of different things, mostly driving convoys. So that's basically how I spent my tour. 11th Cav, back at the time I was there, and I think this probably carried out through the war, used infantrymen for all of their jobs, so that everyone was supposedly able to pull any kind of duty, whether it was night ambush patrol or perimeter guard or the more, shall we say, mundane jobs like KP or barbecue. So, yeah, that's pretty much what I mean.
We talked before that I really didn't want to do war stories as war stories, but could you fit your tour into, you know, events that were going on, you know, the broad historical picture?
Yeah, of course, I didn't really have that perspective when I was there, although I was there during the Tet Offensive. And in fact, I had gone on R&R to Bangkok a week before the Tet Offensive began in Saigon, in the Thon Son Nhut area. And I had just stepped off the plane at Camp Alpha at Thon Son Nhut Air Base when the Tet Offensive began. And there were sappers in the wire, the compound was being mortared and rocketed. And I remember they didn't have steel pots and weapons for us. You know, this was, Thon Son Nhut Air Base was probably the most fortified and secure area, a military area, in Vietnam, at least from my point of view. I wasn't up north, so I don't know how secure Da Nang was, but this was, you know, the equivalent of Da Nang, you know. The people that had the weapons and the steel pots were the permanent party down there who had, you know, occupations, non-combat occupations, like cooks and clerks and stuff like that. And they were the people that were out with the weapons and steel pots, and I found that quite alarming. But it was, you know, for 2 nights, it was basically the first night, and then the second night was a little better because I found out afterwards that a couple of units, 199th and 25th Division, were out there also. And I finally got back to my unit during Tet, and we ended up outside of Benoit, where we got hit pretty good. But by the time I got there, it was kind of the aftermath of that. I missed it while I was down at Camp Alpha.
No, when you refer to Tet, you're referring to the Tet in 1968.
Yeah, January 68, offense. Right. The turning point in the war for many people, Walter Cronkite notwithstanding.
Right.
Yeah, I was there for that. And what I noticed was, just from a personal point of view, a total kind of things like leave. You know, we could go into the city of Swanlock when we didn't have duty. We weren't pulling night ambush. When we were in base camp, we pretty much were free as long as we didn't have a detail. I mean, you kept your weapons clean and vehicles, and you know, if you didn't have KP, barbecue, night ambush, or perimeter, you could probably get permission to go out to Swanlock. Well, that changed. It used to be before Tet, if you went to Saigon, and occasionally I would be on convoys to Saigon, you had to wear civilian clothes if you were U.S. military personnel. Well, that changed. You could no longer wear civilian clothes. You had to wear your fatigues. You had to have unit patches, name tags, etc., rank insignias. This all changed. And that's, granted, very superficial. But it was obviously a command decision that filtered down and manifested itself in these kinds of more stringent measures regarding all free activity.
The controversy surrounding Tetville has always been, did the American government know prior to its, you were there, did you have any awareness of that?
No.
It's a total surprise.
It was a total and complete surprise. I mean, there were certain areas where you knew Charlie was, and you deferred to him, particularly at night. It was never, in my mind, it was not conceivable that he could have gotten as close as he did to overrunning Saigon and to overrunning Tan Son Nhut, and to he didn't really get that close. We know that now. But if it wasn't for a few key command decisions made in the 11th hour before Tet, it very well could have happened. I didn't know it. I wasn't aware of it, but it certainly was.
What do you mean by certain key decisions?
Well, reading, and I forget the general's name, who prevailed. This is brought out by Neil Sheehan in his excellent history entitled "A Bright Shining Lie." I should know his name. It wasn't Wayand.
Palmer.
No, it wasn't Palmer. It was a three-star general.
Davidson.
I could look it up, but I don't have it on my tongue. Prevailed upon Westmoreland to send more troops, get the 25th Division, 199th Light Infantry Brigade, up to Saigon, to that area, because Charlie was massing an attack.
Uh-huh.
And Westmoreland said, no, this is when the discussion between high command was, are the communists interested in Khe Sanh, or is that a diversion? And of course, we know Westmoreland thought that the major attack was going to be on Khe Sanh. He thought that the North Vietnamese and their communist southern counterparts could cause another Dien Bien Phu. and force us to ignominiously withdraw. That, of course, was wrong. Khe-San ended up being a diversion, and the main attacks came, I mean, if you were in Khe-San, it was by no means a diversion, it was a very severe siege, prolonged siege, but the North Vietnamese never attempted to overrun Khe-San. And that was Westmoreland's contention. So, shortly before Tet began, Westmoreland agreed to the realignment of troops into the Saigon area, thereby saving Saigon. But it was, as I said, an 11th hour decision by Westmoreland.
So you saw a definite, though you used the word superficial, but you saw a definite difference in
The way it affected me personally.
Right.
Yeah,
before Tet and after Tet.
Yeah. Uh-huh. There was also a sense, and this would be in the area of troop morale. There was definitely a decline in morale after Tet. It kind of threw everyone for a loop. You know, the fact that Charlie was beaten back and defeated. You know, all over. It took some time. It took more time, for example, in Hue, but he was defeated. But the Vietnamese. The VC and the NVA suffered extensive casualties, much more than we did. I mean, militarily, it was probably a defeat for us, but politically, of course, we know it wasn't. For a kid, I had turned 20 by then. I had turned 20 in Vietnam. I'm saying, well, is it going to end? I mean, this was kind of, to me, in my ability to relate to it, it was kind of a spontaneous eruption by the Viet Cong. And, if they could do it once, I mean, we'd prevent it from doing it ad infinitum, you know? Is there an end to this? I mean, how could we possibly prevent that kind of, spontaneous uprising? So I think it caused a lot of discussion among the troops. A corresponding diminishing of morale.
When you say discussion among the troops, were you aware that, I mean, after Tet probably marks the beginning of, you know, the high point of American anti-war protests leading to Chicago, in Vietnam, were soldiers aware what was going on back home? Were they aware of it? I mean, how did you become aware of it?
For example, my parents sent me the Army Times Union every day. Yeah, I'd usually get six in one day, but it would be for the whole week. So I read the Army Times Union while I was there. At the PX, Time Magazine, Newsweek, all the leading periodicals were available and on the stand.
So news was not censored then?
Oh, no. Not the least bit. And in fact, even the Pacific Stars and Stripes, the military news magazine that came out once a week in Vietnam, even referred to it, although didn't give it as much weight as the... I remember reading Time Magazine and Newsweek following a demonstration. I'm not sure where it was. It may have been in New York City, I think in 67 or 68.
I think it was a major one, March of 68, which...
March of 68?
I think March of 68, right?
Okay.
Yeah, in the spring.
Okay.
In the spring, and
okay.
I have to check that myself.
I returned from Vietnam in April 68, so I could have, certainly could have read about that. I had heard of the anti-war movement.
Did this have an effect? Did it influence soldiers in Vietnam?
I don't know. I personally, I was going through some changes myself. The more I thought about the war, the things that were going on, things that I could see, I wasn't really convinced. I mean, I was kind of doubting all those preconceived notions that I came with. So. Maybe some of the anti-war news kind of fed that. I'm not sure if it was. It was kind of subconscious, but I remember going through a lot of inner turmoil myself, and with some of my buddies over there, we would talk freely about anything, and it was pretty much when we talked about what we were doing, we kind of kissed it off as being just our fate, whatever was going to happen was going to happen. We didn't really think in terms of how we could get out of it or how we could prevent it or stop it or alter it or change it.
I'm really surprised to say that you could read Time and Newsweek, because every war, and please correct me because I'm not, but traditionally in every war there always is a certain amount and sometimes outright censorship of the press.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know, I mean, that could have applied at the front, at the sites, I mean, that there was no front, but I'm not sure what actually got reported back to I mean, you talked to Wallace Terry, who I mentioned earlier. Wallace Terry was a Time correspondent. Now, Wallace Terry can tell you many stories about how the military tried to edit and or sway or influence what he was writing back. But the fact of the matter was, whatever got back there, Time magazine was being printed and available in all PXs of that. I can't remember any. I mean, there were periods of time when you couldn't get to a PX, and when you couldn't get mail from home, and you didn't get your newspapers or whatever. But when you got to the PX or you got back from the field, there you were.
Should on a general level, should the government should they have censored the press? Traditionally, American press has always, to a certain extent, been censored in wartime.
But we know that Vietnam was the first television war.
Right.
I mean, it was on everyone's 6 o'clock news when they sat down to dinner. I don't know if that was good or bad in terms of the outcome of the war. In retrospect, for me, anything that facilitated the end of the war was good, because I got to the point where I didn't think we were there for the right reason. I mean, we were there for the right reason. The right reason was not reflected in our policies. I mean, there was certainly, the idea of democracy versus communism. Now, in retrospect, we can see these communist systems kind of falling, like a house of cards all over. And if we had had foresight then, we'd probably, I mean, who knows, if we had established ties with Vietnam after our withdrawal, their system could be in the process of crumbling now, which unfortunately it's not. But I don't know. I think the motives as espoused by Kennedy and Johnson were certainly noble. But the reality of the matter is, the South Vietnamese people did not feel it important enough to fight the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese. That's what it came down to. And I think the fact that that government collapsed so soon after we left is testimony to that. They just didn't have the will to fight. I don't know if they believed in their system and in their leaders. I think that's the main problem. We ended up supporting the wrong leaders. We could have supported, there's an excellent book entitled A Viet Cong Memoir by gentleman's name is Tang, T-A-N-G. He tells about his experiences. He was the highest ranking member of the Provisional Revolutionary Government. He was the Minister of Justice to defect. He did not like the way the communists were handling the country after the war, particularly the North Vietnamese. But the Provisional Revolutionary Government, that kind of political arm of the Viet Cong, were made up of nationalists. These were people who did not particularly like, I mean, they revered Ho Chi Minh as a national leader, but were not enamored of the communist system, and were not communists themselves. And these are the people who got sold down the river after the Vietnamese took over the country, after the North Vietnamese came down. It was the non-communist people that fought and died as our enemies who suffered in the takeover of the NVA. Now, if we had found those national leaders, and there were great ones, there were incredible people, businessmen. There were businessmen who could have easily been won over to our side if we had courted them. Instead, we ended up with leaders like Diem, who was an arrogant, totally isolated individual, and Tu and Ki. These people did not have the respect of the people. So, therefore, our involvement was doomed because in our absence, those leaders were not able to rally their own people. I just got a long-winded, but...
No. Did you have, you mentioned South Vietnamese people, did you have personal contact with the people in your day-to-day thing? What was their reaction to the Americans?
They loved Americans. They loved Americans. The Vietnamese people are wonderful people, and they loved Americans. Of course, they were making a living off the Americans. And what we did to their economy is criminal. I mean, it wasn't any doing of our own, but the whole military payment system got intermingled with the dong and the piastre system, which was the basis of their economy. And boy, they had a multi-standard economic system.
They were using military script for a while.
But it got to the point where you could spend MPC, military payment certificate, in any Vietnamese establishment, and it was being, introduced into the Vietnamese. You were supposed to, you were told, when you went to a Vietnamese place or purchased anything from the Vietnamese, you were supposed to change your MPC into piastre and spend that. It got to the point where the Vietnamese had a higher regard for the MPC than they did their own currency. There's also, problems with the greenback black market. A lot of things going on that had a negative impact on the Vietnamese economy. But getting back to the Vietnamese, they were wonderful people. People I knew, and I didn't get to know that many because we had just established our base camp when I got there. Unlike some of the more secure areas, we didn't allow Vietnamese to do any of the jobs on our base camp. Some of the base camps had Vietnamese KP, hooch mates, and hooch girls to do the boots. We didn't have any Vietnamese on our base at all. But on convoy duty, I would meet Vietnamese.
So you didn't pick up the any real resentment towards Jews and American money?
Not at all. On the contrary.
Can we digress? This is just personal. You were in Saigon.
I spent some time there. A few times.
Your first guy was really, some guys have kind of, I guess Camp Alpha was right outside it or something.
Camp Alpha was in Tonson Air Base.
Was that closer? Someplace it was.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you're the first guy. Could you tell me just what was it like Saigon during the war? Is that a fair question?
Before Ted, it was, it was a fun place. Yeah, really fun.
Massively big city, is it,
Yeah, even with the war going on, it was a relatively beautiful city. It was built by the French, who colonized the country since the 17th century, or not 17th, but 18th century, I guess. So you had a lot of European and particularly French features, you know, wide tree-lined boulevards and, very grand kind of structures. You know, the U.S. Embassy was a beautiful building. That was a French, what it was before it became the U.S. Embassy. Uh-huh. But, you know, beautiful cathedrals. And so it was a very lovely city with, with a thriving kind of wartime economy, which included drugs, prostitution, and other forms of, black marketeering. Excited for a 19-year-old kid.
Oh, it must have been. You're the first guy I knew who, and some guys they kind of passed through it. Somebody was saying they...
I didn't get to spend a whole lot of time there. I was there, I was living in the Cholon area, which is across the canal. That's kind of a, as I said, a Chinese ghetto. Where I was living on the canal, we had homeless orphans living outside. I mean, that's where I got to meet a lot of Vietnamese. I had a few kids that I would give food to every day. And there was, this guy, I forget what his name was, I just know his name, Nguyen, who was 5 years old and was living alone with his one-year-old brother. He was a five-year-old kid living in the street with his one-year-old brother. They didn't have a home. They were two orphans. And this five-year-old kid had assumed the responsibility of his one-year-old brother. Yeah, I mean, I was totally moved by that, And while I was there, I fed him every day, gave him as much food, as much money, as much anything as I could, But it was then, while I was there in Cholon, I managed maybe to get to Saigon a few times. I was in Cholon for a month, half time, because I'd be one night in Cholon, one night at Sun Lak. So maybe a few times got to Saigon. I was maybe in Saigon for a total of 6 to 8 times.
You have a record right now.
Fond memories.
I'm glad you mentioned about the kids because, talking to guys, sometimes, especially, 10 years ago, the atrocities and everything that supposedly came out of the war. And I think it's a shame that newspapers did not pick up the thing you're talking about, or the guy who was in the Marine. Mm-hmm. And they did basically the same thing. They left camp, and probably sometimes they weren't supposed to leave camp, and they brought kids food, and they built a playground, and all kinds of things. Sure. I think there was so much of that going on.
Oh, yeah, Americans are wonderfully generous and big-hearted. I mean, that's not to minimize what happened at Nila, but Americans are, for the most part, wonderful people. And the Vietnamese loved us. I mean, that was clear. I mean, when we talk about Nila and we talk about wartime atrocities, left here we're talking about remote villages in really strongly enemy-held areas. That's kind of a different situation. The cities were not at any time hostile to Americans. Nor were the larger villages.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I think that's important for the kids seeing this stuff to be aware, because I think sometimes they get caught up in the TV and some of those things that they hear about and et cetera. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else about your stay in Vietnam that you think is important for this tape, or should we get you back home?
Well, I'm willing to talk about anything if you think that's, I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
If you do, just sort of jump. When did you leave?
April of 68. I arrived back and was reassigned to Fort Hood, Texas. As I said, I was with the 11th Armored Cav, and I was reassigned to the 1st Armored Division down at Fort Hood. That ended up being quite an experience in that, as I mentioned, I was going through this kind of transformation from someone who really supported the war when I got there to someone who had misgivings about it halfway through to someone who was opposed to the war when I left. And when I got back to Fort Hood, I was reassigned, as I said, to the 1st Armored Division. And as it turns out, they were doing something that the Army euphemistically referred to as garden plot. And what garden plot was riot control duty. So it became known very early on. I'm down at Fort Hood, Texas during the summer, late spring, summer of 68. It became increasingly clear that the 1st Armored Division was going to Chicago for the Democratic Convention. I had a very hard time with that. And I told my platoon sergeant, I said, Sergeant Norton, I can still remember this guy, he was a great guy. I said, Sarge, I can't go to Chicago with a weapon. You know, I'm back from Vietnam. There's no way that I can bring a loaded weapon into the streets of America. I'm just not going to do it. And he said, well, basically he told me he respected that and he would take care of it. So he arranged for me to stay behind. My whole unit went to Chicago. As it turned out, of course, the military wasn't needed to maintain order there, as we know.
If you want to call it maintaining order, okay.
So, the first division never got into the city of Chicago. But I watched the Democratic Convention from Sergeant Norton's room in my barracks. He left me the key. I stayed in his room and watched.
Was there any reaction to the guys when they came back?
Basically, I knew more about what happened in Chicago than they did, because they never got into the city.
Uh-huh,
they
okay.
were camped out in some place in Illinois, but outside the city. And so basically, I filled in most of the people about what happened. And of course, you know, they managed to get newspapers soon afterwards. Yeah, everyone was pretty amazed.
Yeah, it was an amazing time.
Yeah. Well, it certainly was.
When you came back, had you gone 360 degrees and your attitude towards the war? Were you actively opposing the war?
Obviously, the Chicago situation
took a little courage on your part to say that.
Well, you know, it would have taken courage had my platoon sergeant said, you're going anyway.
All right.
Then it would have required, I don't know. I don't know what would have happened in that case. But, I felt strongly enough about it to bring it to his attention and to tell him that I wasn't gone. I don't know what would have happened if he had not reacted as he did. I was thinking everything through. You know, I'm 20 years old at this point, and, I'm just kind of trying to make sense out of everything, you know. I certainly didn't believe, as after I was discharged that September and went to college, first at JCA and then at SUNY Albany, and got to hear these radical student leaders, I certainly didn't place a whole lot of stock in the kind of truth that they were telling. You know, I knew, they suffered, you know, I was a Vietnam vet who was opposed to the war, but I thought of myself as someone who was a Vietnam vet first, who had some insight, and also who had some experiences that could be useful. This was before I heard any of the leaders in the anti-war movement, and I don't think of a few people off the top of my head. None of them had any understanding of what the GIs were going through. You know, it wasn't until, I don't know when maybe 69, 70, when this whole idea of abusing GIs in the cities and airports subsided. I never experienced that, but I know people that said they did, and I certainly believe them. I never experienced it. But I'm aware of people locally who called me a criminal, a war criminal, because I went to Vietnam, and I fought that. I rejected that. I told the guy so, and I told him why it was so. And I, you know, I was pretty angry about it, and so that was a thing that I also had to work through, you know, because, you know, I didn't feel a part of the anti-war movement because of that, you know, and that was okay with me. I was doing what I could do to bring some sense into ending the war, you know, and basically it wasn't much. It was just my efforts pretty much consisted of talking to as many people as possible and to, you know, agreeing to these kinds of interviews and things like that, which I did.
Would you describe what happened to you? Was that typical? Was there a good number of veterans coming back home and, turning in 360? I mean, I'm aware that there were certain groups out there that, you know, but I mean.
Yeah, and I don't, you know, I attended a meeting of Vietnam Veterans Against War and Fascism, which I thought was a kind of a great title for an organization. you know, it was an offshoot of the Students Against War and Fascism, Youth Against War and Fascism. And it was, I guess it was active on the SUNY Buffalo campus. And a friend of mine was going to SUNY Buffalo. In fact, he was a friend who was a cook at Camp Alpha when I landed during the Tet Offensive. I was out there, never fired a weapon, you know, since basic training. I don't know, maybe had some heavy-duty dinner rolls with him. But anyway, he was also became an anti-war activist and was active in that group of Vietnam Veterans Against War and Fascism at SUNY Buffalo. In Albany, it wasn't much of an organization. I went to one meeting and wasn't impressed with anything about it. So I never joined the war. I wasn't aware of Vietnam Vets Against the War. They weren't active in Albany, as far as I know, at least not on SUNY campus. So I wasn't active in any Vietnam Vet anti-war movement. I did know friends who came back, and we discussed the war, and all of my friends agreed to a man that it was a waste. And we all had arrived at that from various angles, you know. But basically the bottom line was that, as far as we could see, that the killing and the destruction was not worth it. It's kind of an in joke when Vietnam Vets to put down the ARVA. I think a lot of, aside from being kind of a joke, I think there's a certain real important truth in the performance of the ARVA, you know, that should be prominent in discussions about the justification of the war. We all know that if we were invaded by another outside force, say a communist conspiracy from Canada, you know, that we would assume the forefront of that fight. If our allies from France and England sent troops to help us, that would be fine. But the Arvin were not willing to assume the role. And therein, I think, lies the rub.
Experience of, you mentioned at one point earlier, you said when you got back and you were talking to some guy at a bar someplace and you hadn't seen him again, mm-hmm. And he says, where have you been? He said, Vietnam, and he says, you know, and just a while ago, that, you know, at some point after you left, there were other guys you were talking to. Mm-hmm. What was your experience, you know, after you left? Is that the typical reaction with most people?
I think the guys that went to Vietnam were forced to mature and to kind of assemble these heady thoughts and make sense out of, you know, kind of a weird experience. And, you know, the guys that stayed behind, and I don't begrudge this at all, but, you know, they had their exams and their homework to do. Yeah.
Well, that was teaching.
Yeah.
I
certainly have no problem with that. But, you know, so it did occur to me that Vietnam vets were a little more serious about things. But on the other hand, when I got back, I was only 20 years old, and I kind of felt cheated that, you know, I got snatched up and sent away. And I didn't, in a way I felt I had some partying to do, some lost time to make up for, and I ended up doing a lot of that, and for about 5 years, I think.
Hey, at what point did you, what point did you become active in, can I use the phrase Vietnam, that movement, is that a...
Yeah, well, I remember hearing Bobby Muller on TV, I think it was the Ed Donahue show, and I was intrigued about the idea of an organization of Vietnam veterans, and I particularly liked the things he was talking about. And I mean, Bobby Muller, I'm sure you recall Bobby Muller as a brash kind of radical guy, you know. But basically, what Bobby Muller was talking about back in those days was a Vietnam veterans agenda, and the things that we could do as veterans. To help ourselves. So I thought that was a very intriguing idea. So I went to a meeting of VEA Chapter 8 in Albany at the Capitalistic Chapter of VEA, Polish Community Center. And it was at the time there was a lot of infighting going on regarding the direction of the organization. This resulted in the split between VEA and what is now known as the Tri-County Council. So I was kind of an impartial observer of all that, and I did not like the real kind of shall we say, for lack of a better word, bickering that was going on. So I decided that. This was not the time for me to do anything as a formal member of an organization. So I pulled back and thought things over, and maintained a membership both in VBA and in Tri-County after the split, and stayed abreast in political developments among Vietnam vets. As we know, Jack McEnany, who was commissioner of the Department of Human Resources for Mayor Corning, he had a veterans internship program. That's how I was hired. That was probably one of the best things that ever happened to me. It was landing a job with the city of Albany in 1974. And my job at that time was doing some veteran counseling, some employment counseling, and recruitment for this Vietnam Veterans Internship Program. So it was a great program, and I had an opportunity to meet and talk to a lot of vets because of that program. And then I left the city in '83 and went to work as an analyst for the New York State Assembly Veterans Affairs Committee. That's where I got my first real strong induction into Vietnam vet affairs.
And, what do you count? Hal last night said, I kind of chuckled because I was a different person. Hal the other night said, the Vietnam vet is a sexy guy, Mike. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I've been using the phrase Vietnam veteran is dead.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
That's a good question.
10 years ago, that simply was not the case. You know, you had to deal with the stereotype of the early 70s.
Yeah, I think it's the, I think it's a confluence of a lot of different things, coming together of you know, what was happening in the entertainment industry. Some serious Vietnam War films like The Deer Hunter and Apocalypse Now and Platoon and Kubrick's film. Full Metal Jacket. Some very highly critically acclaimed literature. Tim O'Brien's If I Die in a Comet song, Going After Cacciato, along with people like Larry Heineman, Vietnam vet novelists who were winning the National Book Award, the Pulitzer Prize. People were taking another look at who actually served and what was going on. So I think it was a lot of different things, but I think it was kind of a cultural, point that brought us where we are. We had some very good leaders, some good outspoken leaders that were making sense. You know, Vietnam vets never really got into the mainstream of the traditional organizations, you know. We know that Sparky Riegel was the national commander of the American Legion, and there are other Vietnam vets. AFW national commander is also a Vietnam vet. A lawyer from Louisiana, Larry, if you know his name. He visited the memorial there. If you know his name. So we've had some good leaders. We've had some good leaders. We've developed a pretty decent political agenda. And I think our issues are real issues. You know, we're not asking for bonuses. We're not asking for money. You know, what we want is some resolution to some very real problems. You know, Agent Orange, PTSD, and the concomitant readjustment. Those matters that have prevented Vietnam vets from successfully readjusting. So, you know, I think our issues are good, real, and we've had some very good leaders. So I think it was just, it was a combination of time and good leaders and this cultural kind of confluence that brought us where we are today. I don't know how long it will last. So I think it's important that we get our work done.
So, you know, maybe, I'll speculate, maybe it won't be anything, but whatever's going to happen, we'll come together. You know, I don't know. I want to pick up on a couple of things you said. First of all, you said, like, there's summary, whenever you say anything, I got 30,000 things. And if your time be short, tell me, okay, please. Mm-hmm. First thing you said, the Vietnam vet did not work for the traditional organization. So what accounted for that?
Well, a lot of things. I mean, foremost of which would be the fact that we came back without the big win, the big W. You know? We were perceived as losers, although we know, and historians know, that even including Tet, we never lost on the battlefield. That certainly wasn't enough. I mean, granted, but we were seen as not doing the job, I guess.
By the W's.
It was a combination of Vietnam vets not being so inclined to join the organizations, but also there was some resistance within the organizations themselves to Vietnam vets. There are a lot of little anecdotes I can tell you about that. But that caused to further alienate Vietnam vets from the traditional organizations and from society. You know, it was seen as that if the vet organizations didn't want us, well, you know, that would have held us, you know. But, I mean, I don't need to get off on that because the traditional vet organizations have certainly
there
come
seems
around.
To be,
In fact, the American Legion did a wonderful study on PTSD. And, So I mean, there's been quite a change in that regard. And you know, the traditional organizations do support Vietnam veteran issues. They still have their own issues, but you know, that's due to their changing involvement too. Now those traditional organizations are getting, I would say that the Legion certainly has more Vietnam vets than any other organization in the country.
That to a man, that's what the guy say, there's diversions to begin with, and then slowly but surely, mm-hmm. the organization's coming together.
That's not to say there's a majority of Vietnam vets going into organizations. I think there was a study done, I'm not sure who did it. I got this through the Division of Veterans Affairs. They used a number, 18% for the total number of veterans who join organizations. So you've got 82% of all wartime vets that don't belong anywhere.
It's like assuming every Catholic belongs in KSC.
Sure, yeah.
You're much, to borrow Bush's phrase, you're much kinder in general, because there's still lots of resentment towards, I heard the W's once, I've heard, a couple times, mm-hmm. so that may count for why some veterans have chosen not to join.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other thing I want to pick up is, you started to mention some veteran issues. If it's an unfair question, say so, but could you maybe single out what you consider to be in August of 89, mm-hmm. the single most significant issue that the veteran is facing now, maybe over the next couple of years?
Well, it's hard to answer, and I'll tell you why. I would say that potentially the effects of Agent Orange can be the most devastating. It has that potential. We don't know how exposure to those dioxins will manifest themselves in the next 15 or 20 years. I mean, I think Vietnam vet health-related issues are the most important. As I said, Agent Orange has the potential to be the most devastating and pernicious kind of effect of that war. That's at this point, though. I guess it's too soon to tell. That's certainly no relief to families who have to the family of Paul Rudersham and the family of other Vietnam vets, to the family of Ray Forge, who have buried their children because of cancers like non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and soft tissue sarcoma. But it hasn't really attacked us as invidiously as people were talking about 10 years ago. So that still remains a big question for us. I would have to say, in terms of everyday issues, it's the whole cycle of veterans readjustment. You were at the Vet Center. You saw what's going on up there. The Vet Center, which was never in the Reagan administration's plans, and was supposedly going to be phased out a number of different times. Unfortunately, Congress has always acted to reauthorize it. They're doing land office business today. Vietnam vets still suffer from a disproportionate amount of drug and alcohol abuse. Higher incidence of incarceration, and higher incidence of knocking heads within that criminal justice system is in various ways. Vietnam vets are still highly represented among the homeless populations of our cities. So those are kind of issues that I think have a real immediate kind of need.
What do you attribute that to, those things that you're talking about? Well, is that lack of adjustment that we talked about earlier?
I think it's, for many of those people, it's the outward manifestation of post-traumatic stress disorder, how that has kind of cripple them psychologically. In many cases, it's just, you know, late in the war years, 69, 70, I mean, after Tet, when morale started to decline, when the use of heroin was on the rise, when fragging became not commonplace, but certainly quite prevalent. Okay, people developed bad habits then. Not the least of which was just the basic. I went through a period where I didn't know. You know, I went through a kind of a period where I was kind of bothered by my experiences and did a lot of drinking. I realized that it was, and I hope I can use this this word on the videotape, but veterans, at least personally, and I've talked to other veterans who also share this, in order to put up your defenses, you developed an I don't give a fuck attitude. And it was hard to turn that off. In other words, to do things in which your safety was in question without being totally terrified, you had to kind of like cast your faith in the wind, you know, to use a musical kind of image. But so it was hard to turn that off when you came back. When do you start caring and how do you start caring again? So for me, I finally figured that out, that it wasn't right for me not to care about myself and the people that love me and people I loved. So I had to do some work on my own on that. And I don't mean to imply that I had anything nearly as serious as a lot of vets, either in terms of my own experience or in my readjustment kind of dilemma. But I think that's part of it. It's part of the outward manifestations to their traumatic occurrences and this kind of defense that they establish for themselves. So, you know, and it's not to say that Vietnam vets, if we have any psychiatrists or psychologists that are going to watch this, you know, we know that that the Vietnam vets psychological development didn't begin on the day he landed in Vietnam.
Right.
So he brought, many people brought
a lot of baggage with him.
A whole trunk full, yeah.
I sensed last night, and I told you I was really rated the very late in my own, you know, rating
yeah.
videotape
mm-hmm.
for me. I sensed in some cases just the terrible loneliness that those guys felt. You know, the loneliness, you know, we talked about it before, but the loneliness coming home, the botheredness,
mm-hmm.
it really bothered me, the terrible loneliness. Sal said to me, looked me right in the eye, he says, you can understand, but you'll never feel it, or, you know, you can't identify with it. He's right.
See, I was very fortunate. I had a very strong support network. In place. My family was there. I come from, you know, two brothers, a brother and two sisters, and a father and a lot of aunts and uncles. And so I had a very strong support system in place when I came home. And a lot of good friends who I still maintain, you know, weekly and sometimes more contact. Still play a lot of sports, you know, basketball, softball. With friends who I went to high school with. So I was lucky in that sense, and I realized that, and I'm you know, eternally grateful for that. So yeah, that certainly can be another component in that blend of you know, readjustment.
Look, I'm going to keep you here forever. Can you tell these people Mr. Immobile is putting together a program starting in October for specifically for teachers, if I understood what you said.
Yeah.
Would you want to,
sure.
I won't keep you here forever, I'll tell you.
No, I'll just give a little an overview of the program. And I'm flattered that you gave me the credit for it, but actually it's a program that that the New York State Vietnam Memorial will be co-sponsoring, with the State Ed Department, their Bureau of Curriculum Development, the Teaching Center, the Capital District Teaching Center, the State Museum, and SUNY Albany. And what we have in store in October, on Saturday mornings from 10 till noon, is a 13-week program for credit, one credit for attendance and up to 3 credits for a paper, in concert with Dr. Richard Kendall's concert with whatever you agree with him. The program will feature the Stanley Karnow series, Vietnam History. And the first hour of each of these 2-hour sessions, of these 13 2-hour sessions, will be viewing the Karnow video. And the second half will be discussing that material. The Vietnam Memorial will be assembling a panel of veterans, and where applicable, we'll be assembling Vietnam veterans whose experience dovetails the material that was just viewed. And we're very excited about it, and we hope that we'll get a good, positive response in our enrollments.
Sounds good. I've been mentioning as I go around to these guys.
Good.
I think you're going to see it.
Good.
I'm hoping to see it.
Good. We went to the New York State Council on Social Studies, their annual convention, the 57th annual convention, something like that, the Rye Hilton. And we made a little presentation down there. And number one, I was surprised at the attendance at our workshop. Number two, I was surprised at the stuff that was already being done. A lot of teachers have recognized the importance of teaching the Vietnam War, and going ahead and developed their own curriculum. And I think that's wonderful.
It's like I said, it's time has come.
Yes.
New York State is, I think New York State has given us the opportunity to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. The question is doing it right.
Mm-hmm.
Let's wrap it up with my traditional ending question, which mm-hmm. is the worst of all these questions. Since some of these, if not all these tapes, might be seen in classrooms in this area, are there any final words for those 17, 18-year-old kids sitting there watching? Based upon,
Oh, yeah.
Just your, your perspective.
Yeah, very definitely. Number one, if you choose the military, and this is quite a change on my part too, because I was, for a while I was very anti-military, but I now recognize that the military can be a viable career option, and particularly in peacetime, just know.
We're back on. Just pick up. Now we'll just edit that in between stuff. Some of the last night. In fact, I'm not going to hold you forever, because I'll keep you forever. Where they were talking about language before the thing, because they're, shoot this word, shoot this word. And one guy was very strong and said, I think there's certain things that you have to say, and you've got to say it, you've got to use certain words to describe it, And so he was very adamant about, not adamant, but he was going to swear, and I said, I don't care, I'll just put a little footnote, to the teachers, be careful, right? So, and the other guy did not. I don't remember which was which, but funny, but as the night progressed, what happened, the guy who was adamant about swearing, he bullshitted 3 times in a row. I'm never going to get that out of there. I'll have to cut the whole thing, something about this bullshit and that bullshit, basically something about the same thing you knew about the war, and he couldn't understand it, even DM and all those guys, And the other guy who wasn't too thrilled, at one point he says, I'm asking about the American public and the attitude towards it. He says, is this off the record? The film is running. I said, I'll cut it. I don't care. Fuck the American public. And we laughed. And we had, and here this poor lady embarrasses her. No, he's got it. just want to pick it up where you left off.
Pay attention to your political leaders. Probably at your age, you won't really understand how important and how powerful these people are that we put into office. And it's you who will make the decisions whether or not America fights another war. And it's you who will make the decisions whether or not that war is a just war. So know what you're getting into, and know your history. And I hope that you've learned some things with this presentation.
Mr. Bobby, thank you.
Sure, Joe. My pleasure.
Thank you very much. That was great.
I hope it's useful.